Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Welcome to Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. I'm Kate Burdett. Coming up, Jay Fox will speak with Columbus City Council President Shannon Hardin about the Columbus Promise Program. He'll also have an update from an expert about Medicaid cuts. Plus, Face the State will have a look at state politics. First up on Columbus Perspective,
education is a top focus for all of us living, working, and raising children here in Columbus and Central Ohio. Columbus City Council President Shannon Hardin joins us now on Columbus Perspective to talk about a program called Columbus Promise, and he'll explain to us why it is so vital to our community's interests. Welcome, President.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
It's our pleasure. So in a brief few words, what exactly is the Columbus Promise Program?
Sure. In short, the Columbus Promise Program is a simple guarantee that if kids going to Columbus City Schools do a couple things, graduate from high school, apply for the FAFSA, and apply for Columbus State Community College, that they'll be able to go to college for free. Not only will they be able to go to college for free, but that they will be able to get a $1,000 stipend to stay in school, because what we know for sure is that people don't drop out of college just because of tuition. They drop out because their car breaks down or because their rent increases and they need that extra money so they go back to work. So this is a simple guarantee to Columbus City School graduates that they get to go to college debt-free and then give back to our community.
When and how did this program get started?
Sure. So the program is a partnership between the City of Columbus, Columbus City Schools, Columbus State Community College, and I Know I Can. And we started the program in 2021, during the pandemic is when pre-pandemic is when we started preparing for the program. But when the pandemic came along, it really shone a glaring light at the issues of college access, credentialing, and ability for our community to get the credentials they need to participate. College going in 2020 dropped down to 32% from Columbus City Schools. 32% of folks were leaving Columbus City Schools and going to get some type of additional certification or education, and that was drastically low. And so we stacked hands. The city put in $5 million. I advocated to get this program started. We put the $5 million in. I went out and we fundraised for the additional $6 million in about 4 months, and quickly in the fall of 2021 started the program. And let me just tell you, what I am so grateful for is this community supported the Columbus Promise when it was just an idea back in 2021. But since then, the last 3 years, we have had shown data that shows what it means when you give our young people an opportunity, they take it. In 2021, when we started the program, 332 kids from Columbus City Schools about were going to Columbus State. This current class going to Columbus State from Columbus City Schools is over 900. We increased college going from 32% in 2020 to over 52% today. A third of all graduates coming out of Columbus City Schools are now Columbus Promise Scholars. So it has shown amazing, amazing impact and just the ability for more folks to really participate in the Columbus dream or the American dream that says that if you do your part, you work hard, you can get the education and then get the jobs that we are creating here in Columbus.
Now, we're facing educational budget cuts, not just in Columbus and Central Ohio, but truthfully all over the state of Ohio and beyond. How will the impending budget cuts affect the funding for Columbus Promise?
Well, currently, the Promise is funded three primary ways. One, the City of Columbus. I worked with my colleagues on council and supported by Mayor Ginther to secure $10 million for the 6 years of this second phase of Columbus Promise. We are now out fundraising for about another $14 million. We're about $10 million of that raised. So out of the $24 million program, we're about $20 million raised. The third component of funding comes from the federal government. It is Pell Grants. It is the dollars that when we all, anybody who has gone to college in the last 25, 30 years or have children, you fill out the FAFSA. The Pell Grant is the dollars that the federal government gives to folks based off of a financial need. Right now, everybody, Democrats and Republicans, know how important those dollars are to our young people. And one of the things that I love about the Promise Program is it really is not seen as through ideological terms. The biggest Promise Program in the country is in a. So we believe that that there is universal support for the Pell Grant that allows for the Promise Program in conjunction on the local level to work with our local funding and our corporate support.
In a doomsday scenario, if the Department of Education and FAFSA dissolve, what happens?
Well, it would truly be a doomsday. The program. Of the federal government and without the support of the Pell Grant. And that's why I have strong belief that this is not something that is on the ideological chopping block because of its universality and understanding and connection to, at the end of the day, workforce development and credentialing.
Now, Columbus State has been your partner in this endeavor. Will there be other collegiate choices in the mix in the future, or is Columbus State the only choice?
I love that question. So the Promise is really to allow for credentialing in higher education. So right now we have started with Columbus State, but we dream of expanding to a four-year college like the Ohio State University and a historically black college or university like we have in Ohio, like Central State and Wilberforce. And so we believe that for us to actually reach the goals that we have, which is a higher percentage of our community having some level of credentialing after college, we're going to need to expand the program to not just more schools like the Ohio State University, the entire county, as well as to adults even.
So I want to circle back to the funding question one more time. The City of Columbus itself has had to pitch in and make up for funds that the federal government has taken away several times so far this year. Is the City of Columbus in a financial position to continue to do that, not just for Columbus Promise, but for all of the other programs that are somehow financially tied to federal money?
Like I said, I believe that the program is strong. The City of Columbus is in for the Promise and is supporting it at $10 million for the next 6 years. But we do need our federal partners to continue to support the Pell program and allow for communities throughout the country to go to school. I think that it is my belief that Pell is protected because it is not seen as a blue or red benefit. That folks throughout the country in every community, rural and urban, are using the Pell Grant. But it is true to say that it would be very difficult for any Promise program, and Columbus Promise is one of nearly 170 around the country, to continue without federal support.
Now, Columbus and Central Ohio are blessed with a lot of corporate headquarters and a lot of industry. Has there been any discussion, or have you endeavored to form public-private partnerships where there may be A, jobs waiting, or B, some financial assistance from the private sector to continue a program like this and expand it?
Well, we got to remember, the private sector is about half of the support already. This is the quintessential example of a public-private partnership. This next phase of Columbus Promise is $24 million. The city committed $10. We're out fundraising the other $14 million, about $10 million that has already been committed. So the private sector in Columbus is all in because they understand the value that it has to the workforce now, but also to the workforce in the future. And why I say the workforce now is because as we speak, we have a component of the Promise program called Earn and Learn, where folks right now are studying a skill or studying a course, and they are also working in Columbus companies. I love Donato's Pizza. It's my favorite pizza. I'm a hometown boy. But if someone is studying IT or tech, maybe they don't need their second job to be a Donato's Pizza delivery person. Maybe they need to be at a company like IGS Energy that is right here in Central Ohio. And right now, I think it has about 16 Columbus Promise scholars working for them right now alongside their peers. This is the real life implications of supporting this program right here in Columbus, where the public and private sector are working with Columbus City Schools and Columbus State to give these opportunities to our young people.
So you've got 4 years under your belt, which means some people have gone through the program and graduated. What's one example of a graduate success story?
Well, we have a young person who did just what we've always wanted, graduated out of Columbus State. And now is studying at The Ohio State University, got their undergraduate degree for free, is now at The Ohio State University studying towards a four-year degree, and is excelling. They were an Earn and Learn participant working at, I believe, IGS, but a perfect example of how this program can take someone who, one, did not believe that college was for them just a few years ago, and then see them now on their way to a four-year bachelor's degree.
We want to thank Shannon Harden. He is the Columbus City Council President, for taking time out of his busy day today to talk to us about Columbus Promise. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
You're listening to Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's Jay Fox.
Medicaid is a huge topic right now, as both the federal and the Ohio state government are proposing cuts and changes. In Franklin County, over 400,000 people receive health care coverage from Medicaid. Statewide, the number jumps to 3.2 million, of which 1.3 million are children. Leslie Dock is the CEO of the organization Protect Our Care, and he joins us now on Columbus Perspective. Good morning, Leslie.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on and for taking the time for your listeners to learn more about what's about to happen.
Well, let's start at the beginning. What is the mission of Protect Our Care, and when was the organization founded?
The organization was founded in right at the beginning of 2017. I was the senior advisor to the Secretary of Health and Human Services in the in Washington, and we started it in order to protect the Affordable Care Act from repeal by Donald Trump, and led that effort. And then we've continued ever since. Our goal is to guarantee as much as we can that Americans will have access to affordable health care. That is with a large measure focused on the federal government, since there are over 150 million Americans who rely on the federal government, frankly, and state government dollars for their health care. And it's consistently and regularly under attack, as we see now.
We hear a lot of conflicting reports about what may or may not happen with Medicaid. What are the actual potential cuts being planned?
Well, I think there's clarity on the cuts. And there's, because that's what the Republicans in, who are leading this are all about. They're trying to cut Medicaid so they can free up dollars for their massive tax break to people who, frankly, don't need it, and big corporations. So we know what the cuts are. It's between the Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act, the cuts are over $1 trillion in cash. But every dollar translates into a benefit for real people. So we know the numbers. The best information we have on impact comes from the Congressional Budget Office, which is a non-partisan institution. And they say that 16 million Americans will lose their health care as a result of the Republican bill. And that's a combination of almost 10 million from Medicaid and then cuts from the Affordable Care Act. So we know, so that's a huge number of Americans. And in addition, because the bill does nothing to extend the tax credits that make healthcare affordable for people in low incomes who are on Obamacare, we know that millions of them will see their rates skyrocket, but they'll still be able to hold on. So 16 million people kicked off of healthcare, others paying a lot more for the same thing, all to pay for this tax cut.
Let's look at specific demographics, and let's start with seniors. What is the greatest impact that somebody 65 or older might face as a result of this?
That, you know, that really would be that they're relying on Medicaid for their nursing home stays or for care at home, and those are the sorts of things that could be, you know, most at risk for seniors. The people who senior elderly Americans or older Americans who are not protected by Medicare will face more dire consequences.
1.3 million. That was the number we talked about statewide in Ohio for children. How does this impact those children?
Well, it does because, you know, as if their families and their parents get kicked off of Medicaid, those kids are going to suffer as well. And you know, the bill is built basically to have savings by making it purposely kicking people off the rolls by making them have to, you know, fill out endless reams of paper and to make it harder to prove that they're eligible. That's the game here that they've engineered on purpose. And so, you know, we expect a lot of people who deserve health care and who need it are going to get kicked out on, you know, sort of purposefully through this paperwork world that they're creating.
And that specifically also affects minority and marginalized communities. So in a very real sense, what do the people who will be impacted by these cuts, what do they do? What is their alternative to stay healthy?
There really isn't a alternative in terms of getting coverage. And that's why this program has 72 million Americans around the country who rely on it for their health care, because it's the only way they have it. There's no charity in America that can make up for $1 trillion of healthcare costs. It's not possible. And so they basically go to, what happens is they go to emergency rooms. So it's actually incredibly, you know, sad, but also incredibly inefficient, because, you know, what happens is people can't go to a doctor. So they don't, and then they don't know that they have high blood pressure until they wake up, until they're in the, have a stroke and end up in the emergency room. They don't know they have high blood sugar until they show up in an emergency room and know that, find out they have diabetes, or worse, you know, they have stage 4 cancer. So there's no substitute for this. No charity can can take care of this. So that's really what's at stake.
Wouldn't it cost more money for people to end up in ERs and hospital systems than it would to just continue the current system?
Yeah, that's why this is, you know, this is doesn't make any healthcare sense. And the what we need is to give people the ability to get seen, see a doctor, have, as they say, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And that's really true in healthcare. So this is hugely inefficient. And it's just, it's being done because, they, as some of them have said, members of Congress have said, that, you know, everyone's going to die. Or the Republican head of the Medicaid program in Washington said, we need those people to prove to us that they matter. So, you know, this is between the tax cut and how they look down on people who work every day but still need help, or children or parents with kids who demand their full attention. They're doing this, and it makes no fiscal sense, makes no healthcare sense, and it's going to really make people's lives much worse.
So let me ask you this question.
The fact is that, yeah.
Here's the question. A lot of people who will be impacted by all of these changes voted for the Republican Party to take office, voted for the majorities that have occurred in the Senate. How does, what do the polls show? They voted these people
And
now they voted these people in, and now they're going to suffer because of it.
Yeah. And so it's a great question. And the answer has been made very clear, even by Donald Trump's own pollster. So if you go to the polls that have been done by the people who help him get elected, they show that cutting Medicaid is incredibly unpopular with Republican voters and with Trump voters. And when you ask Trump voters, do they know do they know anyone on Medicaid? 40% of them say that I'm on Medicaid, or someone I know well is on Medicaid. And so healthcare is a bipartisan issue in America, except for Washington, D.C., where the members of the House, Republican members of the House and Senate, are quite willing to rip people's health care away. But it is a hugely bipartisan issue in America. 74% of Republicans think it's an outrage to take away people's health care in order to give a bigger tax cut to the rich and to big corporations. So they're not listening to their constituents. I hope will come back and bite them because they're doing exactly the opposite of the people who elected them want them to do.
Is there any hope that it will not happen?
Well, I think we have seen, as evidenced, kind of even by our talk today, that there's a lot of awareness of this issue in America. The polling's very clear about, how popular Medicaid is and how unpopular this bill is. So I do think that people who can, they can go to our website, protectourcare.org, and sort of, see how to call in to their members of Congress and just say they oppose this bill. They know they're doing the wrong thing, and we have to reinforce that every day. But I think it's going to be a long shot for us to actually make changes in the bill now. So we're going to have to, as you said, hold these elected officials accountable for the votes that they make, and work hard after this bill is passed, once the damage becomes so clear that we have another chance of convincing them. I wish I could be, have a better strategy for that. For this moment, I think the best strategy is for them to hear the voices of their constituents.
We want to thank Leslie Dock for being with us today. And for Columbus Perspective, I'm Jay Fox.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan, Now, courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, here's the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV.
Thanks so much for joining us for Face the State. I'm Angela Ann, in today for Doug Petcash. With the big news of the week at the State House, the House choosing to override one of Governor Mike DeWine's vetoes on property tax reform. On Monday, the House voted 61 to 28 to override item 66. 10 TV's Kevin Landers explains what that was and why Ohio House lawmakers chose not to vote on two other vetoed property tax items.
Ohio is facing a property tax crisis.
A crisis?
The Republican majority in this state has repeatedly made a choice to invest less from the state level into our local communities.
That Republicans,
we want to make sure that taxpayers have the opportunity to see what is happening, to have input, and when they vote, they know exactly what they're voting on.
And Democrats,
that our taxpayers desperately need relief,
can't agree on how to get done.
Item 66 provides the transparency our taxpayers are asking.
Item 66 would eliminate the power of school districts to levy property taxes or substitute emergency levies. Today, House Republicans voted to override the governor's veto on the issue by one vote, 61 to 28.
I think this is an important step to show that the House is serious about it.
It is an attempt to lower property taxes by taking away the tools that schools use to raise money. Democrats argue, and the governor has agreed, that if schools lose funding, it will hurt students and teachers.
The state has consistently, over decades, underfunded our schools.
In 1997, the Ohio Supreme Court, in a landmark case called Dural v. State, declared the state's school funding system unconstitutional due to its over-reliance on local property taxes. By 2021, the state's fair funding plan overhauled how states are funded. But critics argue the plan still failed to fund schools adequately. Republicans believe schools need to give their reserve funds back to taxpayers.
Says that if an entity has over 100% of their operating budget in reserve, they can't pass, even place on the ballot, a new general expense levy.
Democrats say property tax relief can't be achieved if the state doesn't allocate more money for schools.
We continue to starve our school districts of the resources they need to be successful, and then we complain when they're not successful.
The House Speaker decided not to vote on two other property tax measures that the governor had vetoed because he didn't feel he had the votes. Now he says those issues will be taken up in the fall. He says the time to act is now.
I guess, flabbergasted that the governor would veto these and say, well, let's just keep studying it.
And that was Kevin Landers reporting. We did ask Governor Mike DeWine what he thought of the vetoes. Here's what he said.
Look, this is part of the process. They have every right to come back. This is not anything personal. If they disagree with something, they can come back. They can try to override. And if they get the votes, they can override. But we're going to continue to focus on, you know, the things that we think are vitally important. And education certainly is high on the list.
So now it is up to the Ohio Senate to vote on the House override. As of today, though, no special session has been scheduled yet for the Senate. In the midst of all this, the governor this week announced his newly formed Property Tax Reform Working Group. Now, this group of 11 is made up of county commissioners, auditors, superintendents, also a treasurer, a mayor, and the co-chairman, names that you might recognize, Pat Tiberi and Bill Seitz. The group will examine how to provide property tax relief to homeowners and businesses without taking away funding from schools, first responders, and libraries. The governor says he wants a report issued by the end of September. Well, property taxes are a pain point that we have heard over and over again from many of you during our 10 TV Listens town halls. We take you to Lancaster today, where reporter Kevin Landers says some homeowners are looking to the state to help them save some money. Here he is again.
Ohio ranks 8th in the country for the highest rate of property taxes, according to Yahoo Finance. Here in Fairfield County, they just received their property tax bills, and many are not happy with the numbers.
I support the schools 100%.
Kathy Grundish moved into her Lancaster home in 1985. She told us she expected her property tax bill to be high this year, just not this high.
What did you think when you saw it?
Well, I knew it was going to go up just because of the way things, cycles go, but I was just like, that much?
Her home shot up in value.
It went up about $65,000. So it's kind of disappointing that, you know, that the taxpayer or the property owners are bearing the brunt.
In Ohio, property taxes aren't about ownership. It's about paying for the services around them, like schools, fire protection, and clean water. You don't pay taxes based on the market value. You pay the assessed value, which is 35% of the auditor reappraisal.
I've been here 40 years, and yes, the property value is great if you sell. But like I said, I've been here 40 years, and I'm really not planning on going anywhere.
Grundich says she worries about those who can't afford the increases in property taxes and says she's getting tired of voting for levies.
What's the alternative to levies? You know, I'm not sure what that is, but it would be great if someone could figure that out.
Governor Mike DeWine convened a group to study the issue.
It has to be real reform that people will see a difference. The people who are hurting will really feel a difference in their pocketbook.
The governor also seemed concerned about what a loss of property tax money could mean to those who depend on them.
We have to fund our schools. Yeah, we have to fund our mental health in the state. We have to do a lot of different things. And a lot of this burden is carried by the local property owners.
Property owners like Kathy Grundich, who says she's on the fence about supporting a property tax repeal that some Ohioans are pushing for.
If it's repealed, then where's the money going to come from?
In Lancaster, Kevin Landers, 10TV News.
Well, right now in the State House, there is a bipartisan bill that would allow local governments to approve liquor sales on Sunday without a local vote. Right now in Ohio, that decision is up to voter approval. So today I'm joined by the co-sponsor behind this bill, Bill 387, Republican State Representative Jack Daniels. Good to have you with us, sir.
Hi there. Thank you, Angela.
It is not lost on me, so I have to ask, and I'm sure you've been asked this before, that your real name is Jack Daniels,
correct?
Like the hard liquor, and you are sponsoring a bill that would open up the sale of liquor on Sundays.
Yeah, I don't think so. Mark Segrist is the other joint sponsor of this,
sure.
And I don't think Mark picked me out because of my name, but it's made a little bit of media buzz. So,
which is good, because you were saying a lot of times bills like this, they don't get the media attention, but this one could affect a lot of business owners, but also people in their local community. So let's talk about the crux of this bill. Right now, under current Ohio law, you cannot sell liquor on Sundays unless you have a special permit called the
right.
D6. Why did you want that changed?
So there's a couple pieces to this. One, to cut some red tape for businesses. These almost always pass. It's an over an 80% rate of passage. Mm-hmm. It's not a controversial topic. There doesn't seem to really be anybody against this. My vision of it is that in 1973, when all of the blue laws in Ohio were basically stripped out, blue laws being regulating alcohol,
sure.
This one was left. And my guess is that back then it was a negotiation between the pro-blue law people and the anti-blue law mm-hmm. people. And that was what just got left as a little morsel. If an establishment is established and is succeeding in a community from Monday through Saturday, the concept of Sunday sales, maybe it was a big deal in the 50s and 60s, but it's really not today. So we want to cut some red tape for the small businesses. It still leaves the opportunity for it to go to the ballot. It gives the control to the locals, and that's the most important part to this is the local control.
So you also talk about this would cut through the red tape. Will this save taxpayers any money in the long run?
Yes. In particular, in my town of New Franklin, we had a ballot initiative. It was a little hard to explain how it happened, but it was the only ballot in all of Summit County. Well, by law, Summit County then had to open its Board of Elections. We have early voting, so they had to open the early voting office for 30 days. Mm-hmm. They had to staff that. It cost just under $44,000.
Okay.
Seven people voted.
For that one issue?
For that issue, seven
wow.
people voted. The city of New Franklin was forced to pay that. It was not done on purpose. It was not that, you know, the gas station that wanted the Sunday sales didn't realize what they were doing. The city didn't catch it, didn't know about it until after it was too late. It had already been filed with the Board of Elections. So by the time we realized this was going to have to happen, it was too late to make a change.
And so you're saying basically this can happen where you are up in Summit County. This could be happening elsewhere in any of the 88 counties in Ohio.
Correct. Yeah. Elections cost money.
Sure.
And voters deserve the right to speak. And this does not take their right away. They can still speak. they can always do a referendum. Now, there's a little bit of confusion, and this bill, I also want to say, Mark Segrest and I have talked about the fact that we're at the beginning of this. There's a process, the committee process is where we bring in sponsor testimony, or our sponsor testimony, proponent, opponent testimony, and we learn through that process. So there will likely be amendments to this.
Sure.
One of those is how that will work if there is a community uprising that wants to stop the community sales after the trustees or the council members have voted
to pass it. Yeah. And you speak about opponents, so let's talk about some critics who have already said, you know, could this possibly give local municipalities too much power in approving something that you said maybe the community doesn't want, but that local municipality power is perhaps persuaded by the business in some way to pass this, and that is where critics are concerned.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the focus of how this referendum, I think is the correct term.
Okay.
We're not sure. So right now you have to have 50 signatures to get this on the ballot.
Right.
So if you want Sunday sales, you have to get 50 signatures. We're not sure whether to get it pulled off if a township or a council votes for it to allow it. Well, first, two things have to happen. First, the council or trustees have to say that we're going to allow Sunday sales without a ballot.
Right.
So right now, the default, even after this bill passes, will be that it still goes to the ballot, unless the local municipality says we're going to allow without a vote of the people, but it will still have to be passed by that legislature. So then the next question is, what will it take to overturn that should the community have a problem? In my experience, and in Rep. Segrest's experience, where they have successful establishments Monday through Saturday and they don't have a community problem, Sunday is a pretty simple thing. It really seems like a law that dates back many, many years when alcohol was perceived very differently than it is now.
Sure. So. And this bill actually, you were saying, has bipartisan support. We're looking at 21 co-sponsors along with you and Mark Segrest. Does that surprise you? There's that much support from both sides?
It does not. A couple of reasons. Number one, Rep. Segrest and I both have a very bipartisan attitude. We want to find things that we agree on. You know, this country is full of communication and media that talks about what we disagree about. When we can find something we agree about, we need to focus our energy on that.
Sure.
And that's how we can move things forward. So it really wasn't a surprise. I expect there's going to be more support for this as it goes on. It's summer, so some people aren't paying as much attention.
So you say this is really just the first step. It was introduced on July 1st. Surely there will be public hearings, so on and so forth.
Correct.
How long do you expect this process then to take if it were to just sail right through?
Well, if it were to sail right through, we could see it enacted this fall. I think that's unlikely. Usually the sausage-making process, as people say in government. I'm new to government, so is Rep. Segrest. We're both from the business world. It's a nice thing about Ohio legislature. There's a lot of people there that are not career politicians because of our term limits. My guess would be it'll be a next year success because the committee process starts now. And the committee process is a very robust process where both sides come in and make their argument. And, hey, if we don't get any opponent testimony or little to none and we get a lot of proponent testimony, the speaker could bring it to the floor pretty quickly. Of course, it's up to the speaker to bring it to the floor.
Well, we will certainly follow this, House Bill 387, right, as it moves through. Thank you so much, Representative Jack Downs, for joining us here on Face the State.
Columbus Perspective is a public affairs presentation of WBNS Radio. The opinions expressed on this program are those of its guests and do not necessarily reflect those of WBNS Radio, its staff, management, or sponsors.
The Fan.
This is Columbus Perspective on The Fan. Here's more from Face the State, courtesy of 10TV.
Solar developers have met some pushback in a lot of Ohio's rural counties, but one development in Knox County is moving forward after getting approval from the state. 10TV's Colin Dorsey has a look now at What's at Stake.
Industrial solar. It's been a contentious topic in Knox County for several years. Just this year, county commissioners went so far as to ban any new industrial solar developments in nearly all of the county's townships. Much of the debate comes from the Fraser Solar Project being developed by Open Road Renewables. It's set to go on this farmland leased south of Mount Vernon. Dan Check is with Open Road Renewables. The company currently operates at least three solar facilities in Ohio, with more in the works. The Fraser Project in Knox County recently received approval from the Ohio Power Siting Board, meaning it will move forward, but opponents of the project plan to appeal that decision. I took some of those concerns about the project to the company. The
biggest concern about this was land preservation of farmland here in Knox County.
Yes.
How is Open Road Renewables addressing that?
It will continue to be utilized in some capacity for farming purposes. And then, of course, the decommissioning bond that we post as a developer ensures that we cover the entire cost of restoring this land back to its original state or as close as possible.
Along with returning the land back into farmland at the end of the lease, Check says sheep will be brought in during the operation of the solar field to graze on vegetation. The company says the massive project will be capable of producing 120 megawatts of power for the grid just off the sun.
Some of the opponents out there who say the power generation of these solar fields is largely overestimated. Do you correct that?
This technology has existed for quite a while and has been proven. So in terms of what the yield would be, I'm fairly confident in the engineers who designed the project that they've done a good job.
There's the opposition, there's me and the supporters, and then there's this great big middle, you know, that you just don't want to think about it, you know.
Kathy Gamble has lived in Knox County her whole life and made her living working in and around agriculture. She supports the project. These signs lining her driveway show that support.
What got you on board with saying yes to solar in Knox County?
Property rights.
For her, it's also about bringing development into the county and her interactions with the people from Open Road Renewables.
When problems did arise with their projects, they fixed it. It's not like they just walked away and that was the end of them.
Even though the Fraser Solar Project got approval from the state last month, there are still several hurdles for it to clear before Open Road Renewables can break ground. In Knox County, Colin Dorsey, 10 TV News.
Again, that's courtesy of our sister station, WBNS 10 TV, from the Sunday morning public affairs program, Face the State. A new edition can be seen this morning at 11:30 on 10 TV. This has been Columbus Perspective, a weekly public affairs presentation of The Fan. Heard each Sunday morning at 6 on WBNS FM 97.1 The Fan and on 1460 AM ESPN Columbus.